This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, you know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the St. Jude kids. St. Jude's doing incredible work fighting childhood cancer. And because of donations like the ones that you give, families never receive a bill ever from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, food, none of that. Help St. Jude stop childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope. Get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. It's going to look great on you. So join all the doctors, researchers, and me in this fight. All right, text the word Bobby. It's only 6 numbers to 785-833. Again, text the word Bobby to just these 6 numbers, 785-833. Welcome to episode 268. We'll do CMA award facts you didn't know. Remembering Jerry Jeff Walker. Tom Lord on what goes into artist management. Maybe something you heard about but you didn't know much about. Jamie Lynn Spears is on this, but it's all about music. Let's start with new music this week. Here are the 5 that I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. First up, Bush released a new album. You would know them from their old song. Here's one of them, Glycerine. And if you're new at the guitar, you probably learned this because it's the 4 chords over and over and over that are very easy to do. But they put out the Kingdom Deluxe Edition with this song, Heroes, which is a tribute to David Bowie. It's a David Bowie song. Here you go. We can be heroes just for one day. What you say? And number 4, I'm putting a little Christmas music here. Brett Eldridge and Kelly Clarkson released a new Christmas duet called Under the Mistletoe. Speaking of Christmas, Hootie and the Blowfish and special guest Abigail Hodges have released a new holiday theme track called Won't Be Home for Christmas. At number 3. We will talk on the phone, but it won't be home for Christmas. That's cool. We have God on our side, but we won't be home for Christmas. Man, maybe I should have made that number 1. That's good. Cam has a new album called Other Side. Here's a song you may have heard that's already from it called Classic. I wanna hit rewind, baby. And here's a brand new song called Like a Movie from Cam's new album that's out today. But when it's right, it's like a movie. Standing still, but still you move me. And at number 1, I gotta put our guest today, Jamie Lynn Spears. She released Follow Me. It's a reimagined version of the Zoe 101 theme song. And we'll talk to her coming up. Here's a clip of that. Now, I'm not going to listen to this myself, but I love Jamie Lynn Spears. Her and I have been friends for a long time. She's back with Zoe 101, and she's on the podcast. So I don't want her to hear this back and not have her at number 1. You know? Kit Moore also, as an honorable mention, announced he's releasing Wild World Deluxe in February, which featured his song She's Mine. Yeah, baby, she's in Vegas. It's got 4 new songs, including one that's out now. It's called Don't Go Changing. And don't go changing on me, baby, 'cause this world is turning. As far as albums go, Wynonna Judd put out her Recollections EP, 5 new songs. Ariana Grande has a new album called Positions. Elvis Costello has a new album. Goo Goo Dolls, It's Christmas All Over. The Goo Goo Dolls are back. A 90s Christmas. I thought it would be like early 2000s Christmas, I guess.
Yeah.
Like it's a 2001 Christmas with the Goo Goo Dolls.
Tori Kelly has a Christmas album. Joni Mitchell has Archives Volume 1, 1963 to 1967. There's a Stevie Nicks Live in Concert out today. Sam Smith, Meghan Trainor has a very Meghan Trainor Christmas, a very Trainor Christmas. So a lot of Christmas stuff coming out now. As far as news goes, Billy Joe Shaver, pioneer of outlaw country, dead at 81. I was a big Billy Joe Shaver fan. I love Live Forever as one of my top... Just like the songs I... Hold on. I love Live Forever as like a top 25 song for me. Billy Joe Shaver died of a stroke at Waco, Texas, Ascension Providence Hospital. If you loved Texas country, you love Billy Joe Shaver. He rose to further prominence after Kris Kristofferson recorded his song, Good Christian Soldier. He wrote stuff, you know, Live Forever, Highwayman, 1995, other numbers, Elvis, David Allan Coe, Patti Loveless, Doug Kershaw, Johnny Paycheck, just so many people he wrote for, but yeah, that's sad. Jerry Jeff Walker and Billy Joe Shaver. We'll talk about Jerry Jeff Walker later on, huh?
Yep.
Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You hit 1 billion views on YouTube. With a B, a billion. There will be an Eddie Van Halen tribute during the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction special. The number one song in the country this week is Mood by 24K Golden. Why you always in a mood? I just know it from TikTok. I was listening to the pop station the other day, and I knew like 4 songs in a row. Caitlin was with me. She was like, I can tell when you've been on TikTok because you know all the songs. Otherwise, I wouldn't know any of them. And then AC/DC used fireworks to find the Loch Ness Monster. Do you know about this, Mike?
I do.
Tell me about it.
I think they were all drunk on tour, and they were like, hey, let's try to get the Loch Ness Monster out. So they fired out a bunch of fireworks.
I would expect nothing less. All right, there you go. I hope you enjoy this one. That's your new music. Thank you, guys.
Bobby and Eddie's Music School is now in session.
Up in the morning and out to school. Eddie, how are you?
I'm great, Bones. How are you?
Pretty good. We're going to talk about, with me, my first one is the CMA Award fact you may not know. Because here we go. It's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see here. It's from the recording of what we're doing, we're 2 weeks out. By the time people will hear this, it'll be about a week and a half out. Right, Mike? From the CMA Awards. Entertainer of the Year. That's the big one. The history of the first CMA Entertainer of the Year, since we'll talk about it with Tom Lord coming up in a second. The very first CMA Awards took place in 1967, which means this year the Country Music Association will crown its 54th Entertainer of the Year. But which artist do you think was first to take home this prestigious award?
54th. Hank Williams.
It's a good guess. The honor belongs to Eddie Arnold.
Oh, okay.
A pioneer of the Nashville sound. Nicknamed the Tennessee Plowboy, Arnold had 145 songs make the country charts during his 60-year career. 28 went number one. That feat puts him second to only who, do you think, for most songs on the chart? Country.
Country. Johnny Cash.
Again, solid guess.
But no, you're wrong.
George Jones. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1966 and died in 2008. Some of his number ones include, from Eddie Arnold, this is It's a Sin.
It's a sin, my darling, how I love you, because I know our love can never be.
Here's another one called Cattle Call.
Whispers are a jingling, a cowboy is singing this lonesome cattle call.
And one final one, Make the World Go Away.
Make the world go away.
One,
that's
man.
The only one I know of those three,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, me too.
And I like to think I'm pretty smart when it comes to history, but if I'm just being honest, I didn't know the first two.
But I remember Eddie Arnold with the first kind of sound that you played, the first song with more, a little more country swing. That's how I remember Eddie Arnold, but I do remember this song.
Can you picture Eddie Arnold in your head?
Yes, a lot of glitter.
What he looks like?
Yeah, but big tall gallon, what do they call it, 10-gallon cowboy hat and a lot of glitter or rhinestones on his suit. Is that accurate?
The Eddie Arnold I see, old Eddie Arnold, yes. I think, had a big hat, yes. Let's talk about the origin of the trophy. The current CMA Awards trophy is supposed to be designed like like a chart bullet and is made from a crystal imported from Florence, Italy. Because it's kind of like this.
Yes, ovally sharp.
And it's glass.
Mm-hmm.
Originally made from walnut, a shortage of the wood supply in 1983 led to the crystal design. They didn't have any wood, so they just made it nicer.
Crazy. Yep, didn't know that. Man.
It's been in Nashville every year since 2005. It was only at Madison Square Garden in New York City one time. The 2020 CMA Awards are November 11th. Will air live from Nashville on ABC. Due to the coronavirus, the show will be hosted at Nashville's Music City Center, not Bridgestone Arena, which is customary. Mm-hmm. There will be no live audience. There will be some people there, though. I'm a part of the show. I can't announce it yet. Heck, I'd hoped to host it. Didn't get that job this year.
Dang it.
Felt like I was in the running, though.
Dang it.
Till the
so
last
close.
Second. I know. But there'll be people in the audience, but it won't be a normal crowd. I think it's just going to be people that may be up for awards and people that are a part of the show. I chose not to. I'm not going to sit in the crowd.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and walk through a back door, not be around anyone, just get out, like the ACMs.
Stay safe.
Mm-hmm. The first female CMA Entertainer of the Year. Who do you think that was? It's tough. I'm asking you crazy.
Yeah.
1972.
I'll guess the Loretta Lynn.
Correct.
Yes. Got one.
You got it. Yeah. Here's a hook of Coal Miner's Daughter from Loretta Lynn. Here you go.
Well, I was born the coal miner's daughter.
Only six other female performers have won the award. Can you name any of them?
Dolly.
We'll only have Dixie Chicks and Taylor Swift. I thought they would all be listed here.
I mean, maybe Dolly's in there. I don't know.
Garth Brooks and Kenny Chesney have the most Entertainer of the Year awards.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Finally, Eric Church, Luke Combs, Miranda Lambert, Carrie Underwood, and Keith Urban are up this year.
Now, I remember reading a while back that, you know, because some article that was differentiating the ACMs and the CMAs. Is it accurate to say that CMAs was the Nashville award show?
Completely accurate, because okay. The ACMs were California West Coast Country.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why the show is always in Los Angeles. It was in Nashville this year because of coronavirus and all the artists weren't going to travel. But yes, that was California West Coast Country.
And now Vegas is where they have it.
Yeah, West Coast, yes.
Yeah, crazy. I didn't realize
they've
that
done
until
it
this year.
In Los Angeles a few times, too.
I think it started in Los Angeles. Pretty cool.
That is my version of Music School. Eddie, over to you.
All right, so we're remembering Jerry Jeff Walker. At age 78, he lost his battle to throat cancer. And, man, he just really was the soundtrack of my high school years, my college years. And I love Jerry Jeff. And one of the cool things is just kind of going through Instagram and seeing the artists that posted, you know, about his death. And Jimmy Buffett was one of the ones that kind of stuck out to me, because if it wasn't for Jerry Jeff, cool little factoid, if it wasn't for Jerry Jeff taking him to Key West, Jimmy would have never really found that beach sound he was looking for.
Wow.
It was Jerry Jeff that drove him to Key West for the first time. And Jimmy ended up loving it and staying there and writing songs there, which became kind of the background of his beach sound, if you want to call it that. But that's pretty cool. And also, too, just kind of growing up in Texas my whole life, Jerry Jeff was the godfather of Texas country, you know. And it's cool to kind of know where he came from, because these artists, you know him as the sound, like I just said, Jimmy Buffett, right? But Jerry Jeff started in New York. He's a New Yorker, and he started there in the 1960s in the Greenwich Village sound. So with Dylan, Dave Van Ronk, you know, those folk singers, that's what Jerry wanted to be.
Change his name.
Change his name completely. Mm-hmm. That's where he changed his name. So coming to Texas, he's like, no, this is who I am. This is where I feel very comfortable, and started that Texas country sound, which is pretty cool, man. And I think we all know him from Mr. Bojangles.
Mr. Bojangles. I think a lot of people, though, don't know that he wrote that, because the Bob Dylan version, to me, was the one that most people know.
Do you remember the Nitty Gritty version? Nitty Gritty Dirt Man?
I don't.
I feel like I know it,
but I don't remember it. Like, I know it now, but I didn't know it from back in the day.
Yeah, that's kind of where I come from, too, is like, I do remember hearing that. I don't remember who I knew it from, but Bojangles, to me, was a very famous song, but I never knew who did it. It always sounded like it was something that Bob Dylan did, so I do remember him singing that. But once again, high school, when I got the CD of Jerry Jeff singing Mr. Bojangles and researching where did this come from, it's Jerry Jeff's song. This is his song. Wrote it back in New Orleans from, you know, he got arrested for public intoxication, got thrown in jail in New Orleans, ended up meeting this guy who was a homeless dude and his dog. And he was telling stories of his dog and how he died and all this stuff, but he would dance in the jail cell. So he wrote Mr. Bojangles because of that. Pretty cool.
Other clips we have, Sangria Wine.
These are kind of my top three Jerry Jeff songs. Sangria Wine to me.
Love
sangria wine.
What else you got?
And I got Getting By also. And I picked these songs because these are written by Jerry Jeff. And I didn't know him personally, but I felt by listening to Getting By that this is kind of how he lived his life. Just one day at a time. Getting by, living my life, easy come, easy go. And that to me really hit me, you know, when I was listening to it the weekend that he died. But Getting By, man, this takes me back.
To when? Wasn't this before you were
high school? No, just listening to this. Okay. Hanging out with my buddies. We would just have parties and just blare Jerry Jeff Walker.
I don't even know when this was recorded. Is this an older song?
Yeah, this is 70s.
Okay. That's what I thought. When I said that, I was like, you know what? I could be wrong.
And Luckenbach, too, is, you know, this is where he recorded a lot of these songs. Not really with a crowd, but just to go to Luckenbach, take the tour bus, and just go record an album there. Pretty cool.
There you go.
Jerry Jeff, man, rest in peace. But like you always say, it's so cool that we're going to have his music for the rest of our lives and then lives to come for sure.
And that is Bobby and Eddie's Music School.
Class dismissed. That was Bobby and Eddie's Music School.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, that's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833. Now, I wanted to bring someone in and talk about management because it's not really something we've talked about a lot on the show other than me going, I got to pay him 15%. I mean, that's mostly... It's mostly me griping about, but in a loving way, because I know I make more than 15% off the 15% I pay.
So I wanted to bring in Tom Lord of Red Light Management. What is your overarching title there?
Well, we don't have official titles, but I'll tell you my role, which is basically describing a title. I was brought in from Universal Music Group. I was a record label guy. Came into management about 7 years ago to help build the marketing department. So I was head of marketing for our Nashville office, and then that sort of has evolved, and there are a handful of us that run the office and help Corin, who that's a name I'll probably say in this podcast a couple of times, help Corin, who is the head of the company, run the Nashville office. And that's some of the basic logistical things of the office maintenance, its hirings and firings if necessary, and just kind of general maintenance of the management team in Nashville. And then management roles as well. So I have a couple artists that I sort of have under my supervision from a manager role.
And full transparency, I am one of them. So is the Raging Idiots, which is one and the same, except not. Gabby Barrett,
mm-hmm.
You work with Gabby. I mean, I worked with Gabby 4 years ago on Idol.
Yep.
I remember those conversations like, okay, Gabby's coming to... Let's get her. And the early ones, and then watch. Yep. And you were so instrumental in her even landing a record deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So before we get to that specifically, like, why in the world would someone need a manager? Because most folks don't even know. When someone gets up and gives a speech and they're like, oh, I think our manager, we all just roll our eyes because we don't know what that means.
Well, that's what I was going to say. This podcast may be your least consumed podcast because I'm not sure people really know what management is or have any interest, but I do think it's important. It's definitely a big part of this industry.
The biggest. For me, it's massive for what I do, and it's not something I talk about because I'm not embarrassed of it, or I don't think people aren't interested, but it's just so in the weeds.
Yes.
But that's what this podcast is.
Yes.
So why in the world would someone need a manager?
The best way to describe it is to put it as an analogy for running a business. You know, the artist is the chairman of a business. That's your business. You know, in your case, you have a business that you need to run. And that includes for you specifically, it's touring, it's merchandise, it's philanthropic efforts, it's personal appearances, it's publishing, book deals, it's, you know,
TV, radio, everything.
Everything, yeah. You know, and so, you know, with your need to be creatively involved on all those in all of those facets of your business, you need somebody to help run your business. So you're the chairman, and we're your president of the company. So we help run the PR department and finance department and merchandise department, the philanthropic department, merchandise, the whole ball of wax. So we just, our job is to make sure all of the pieces of the business are connected and that are working and help execute your goals. That's what a manager does. And you know, we're in the weeds with everything, you know, when we try to keep the artist out of the weeds, but all of it is with their direction. And we come as, you know, in the case with you, if there's anything that comes up, we don't sign off on it unless we know that's something that you would sign off on, or we come to you and ask specifically for your yes or no on certain things. So that's really the role of the manager, if that answers that right.
With Gabby, like, what do you deal with day to day with, she's got a number one song, but a pretty new artist in country music, because I would imagine that's a lot different than someone who has been around for a bit. So what is it with in the Gabby process that you're dealing with right now?
I'll start with when I first started working with Gabby, what that role was, and then kind of where it is today. When I first started working with Gabby, you know, some of it was just even pretty basic education about Nashville in the music business, because that's the other thing I think a manager is important for an artist. Is an artist generally walks into becoming an artist, or, you know, sort of declares that they're going to become an artist, but they don't know the facets of business. They don't know the avenue. They don't have the roadmap to be able to navigate a label conversation and a publisher conversation and who's the right merchandise person or the booking agency, who are the right people that I need to talk to. So that is what the experience of a manager has and helps bring to the table for an artist. And that was in the case with Gabby early on. She came out of American Idol, and that is an amazing platform, as you know, and are deeply involved with. It's an amazing platform to build an audience, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee you the record deal and the publishing deal or merchandise deal or the get on a tour, et cetera, et cetera. And so when Gabby first came off of Idol, as mature as she was for her age, and she came off of Idol and she was 19 years old, you know, she needed some education on how Nashville works. And so I felt like the first part of my job with her was sort of setting the tone for, hey, here's the reality of the situation. You came off an amazing TV show, gave you a great platform, but no labels are jumping, you know, to sign you. And so now what we have to do is prove it to them. And so it was helping set the, I think, the roadmap for building a reputation outside of Idol, building a reputation as an artist in the town and starting to be part of the community. So that was a big part of it then. And then it was with her and navigating with 19 Entertainment, who is also part of the American Idol family, who was a part of the mix, but they're not necessarily part of the Nashville community, that we navigated releasing her song, I Hope, without a major label deal. And that was where, you know, my role as a marketer and also manager came into strong play with her to help, you know, kind of work with the DSPs, which are the digital partners. It's the Spotify's, the Apple's, the Pandora's, and Amazon's, to make sure that they knew this artist was coming, that they knew who she was and what she was about, finding a PR person, you know, it was sort of building the team. I think that was a big part of it. Building the team was another part of the early roles. And then we get the major label deal, and then it's, you know, then we release the single out to terrestrial radio, and it has done tremendously well. So my role, I would say, has evolved from when we first started working together to today. And I think today, the role of my job with Gabby, and we have a lot of conversations about it, is, you know, she understands that we've had an amazing first step, and we're having a moment. Is sort of, this is my cliche thing that I say, and I say it in almost every meeting we're in, is that, you know, we're having a moment, but we need to make a movement. And so that is now, how do we navigate from the I Hope artist into an artist that has, you know, repeated success? And so we're trying to, as you know, as we never want to, you know, sort of look a gift horse in the mouth here, but, you know, with the success that we're having with I Hope and continue to have, I'm trying to move past it in a lot of ways, to say, hey, look at this song, and it's the good ones, that's our next single. And so my job now is trying to change the spotlight a bit. You know, let's enjoy the spotlight that we've got with I Hope, but let's try to shift the spotlight to show the success that we're having with the good ones, because we know we need to move from this moment.
There has to be a maturation.
That's exactly right.
With an artist like Chris Jansen, who I know you're involved with, Chris and yep. Kelly. Kelly's his manager, his wife, and you're also involved in Chris because he's at Red Light as well. Obviously, he's a lot older, had been around a lot longer, had been in Nashville way before you got involved with Chris. So how is that different situationally with Chris than with Gabby?
The approach is very different. You know, with Gabby, it is, you're building a introduction. It's a first impression that you're trying to build, and that has a strategy to it. You know, you only have the one time to make a first impression, as they say. And, you know, and so for her, it's building the right first impressions. For Chris, there's at least some history there that you're able to jump into that, because Chris had previous management, and as you said, had different record deals, and when he came over to Red Light. And so what we're able to do in that case is sort of look at the history and go, okay, let's look at what you have done. And now you've already made an impression in the marketplace. And is there anything with that impression that we need to change? Do we need to evolve that? Do we need to grow that? And I think I think it's okay to say this, because it was definitely my strategy when first working with Chris. And that was kind of building, again, sort of repeatable success, because I think there was a impression with Chris that he was the surprise hitmaker with Buy Me a Boat. And the reason I say surprise hitmaker with Buy Me a Boat, because he had had a couple of record deals. And at some point in this industry, love it or hate it, sometimes the industry churns you out. After you've had a couple of record deals, you've sort of lost your opportunity. And Chris released Buy Me a Boat independently. This is even before signing with Warner, released Buy Me a Boat. And it just, with the help of Bobby Bones Show, plug, did you get that plug? With the help of Bobby Bones and the Bobby Bones Show, put him back on the map. And so that became a surprise hit. And then all of a sudden the record labels are calling again. And so, and he was having success, but he wasn't able to replicate necessarily the success of Buy Me a Boat after that song had come out. And so, as I talked about with Gabby, sort of trying to find that repeatability, I think with Chris, that was the strategy when we first started working together. It's like, hey, we need to prove it. Chris, we know you've got the talent. We can hear it in the songs. We hear it in the record. We know your talent. We know what you can do on stage. But now we need the town to see you as more than Buy Me a Boat. And I think I would put Chris and Gabby almost in the same category, is that they're that first major hit that they both had, in Chris's case, Buy Me a Boat, and in Gabby's case, I Hope, those songs will always follow them around. It is hard when you have a song that is so big, that is really the first big hit for an artist. you know, that will follow you around for your whole career. And you just, the job is never to try to repeat that exact song success, but you've got to then evolve from it. And I think from Chris, that was the case. It's like, we got to show people that you're more than that. And since then, he's, and this is all on him because he's the songwriter on all these songs, but it's Fix a Drink and it's Good Vibes and it's Drunk Girl and it's Done. And now Waiting on Five is the current single. He has now repeated success. So I think the strategy changed with, you know, and it was different when I started working with Chris versus working with Gabby. And so I think that's how it was different for Chris.
If, and there are a lot of artists that listen to this podcast because we do go in the weeds at times with publishing, now with management, obviously. Sometimes they're like, how the heck do I get a manager? And my answer is always the same when anyone's asking, how do I do anything? It's play as many places as you can be and hopefully you catch someone's eye. That's just my general answer because I know that's not wrong. It may not be right, but it's not wrong. So as someone who is pretty high up at the biggest management company in town, I'm assuming Red Light's the biggest in town. It is, right?
It's the biggest independent management company, I think, in the world, the way that it's in its setup. And I think from a number of staff and artists, probably the biggest.
So how does one that's unmanaged get a manager?
Man, so many avenues for that. And, you know, if you're an aspiring artist and you're listening to this and you want to say, man, how do I find a manager? You know, managers come in different shapes and sizes. I tell you, the role of the manager is somebody that you can really trust. And I hate to say that anybody can be a manager, but to a certain extent, you know, there are a lot of people, and I listened to the podcast, actually my prep work coming into today was listening to the podcast with Carrie Edwards. She wasn't a manager when she first started working with Luke, but she was somebody that believed in Luke and Luke trusted, and they had built a rapport together and, you know, just found that sort of synergy to lean on each other. And, you know, look at the success that they've had, and she is his manager still today from the day one. But she didn't start that way. She was a publisher, and prior to that, she was at a record company. And so I think you can find a manager in anybody, but that you trust and that you've built a relationship with. But, you know, I think from my perspective, we get sort of recommendations from artists, from attorneys, from publishers, from record companies. You know, we get recommendations a lot. That's how we find artists mostly. Is from the publishing community or from the booking agents that have seen an artist down on the road. If you're an artist and you haven't necessarily built those relationships, to be honest with you, I don't know that you need, manager is probably not the first move that you need to make. You don't need to go, hey, I need to go get a manager and then I can build everybody. I think probably you start with, if you're a songwriter, you start in the songwriting community and you build your relationships with the PROs, and that's a BMI or ASCAP or CSAC. And then they help develop and build relationships into the publishing community. And then once you build into the publishing community, that starts to build out your team. And that's where a manager really is a valuable part of the team. It's probably not the first team member you have in most cases. It's when you're at a level where you're ready to go in the marketplace and you've got to make some of those decisions and pitch to the labels and you know, kind of make the touring moves, that I think the manager is probably the most important component of your team at that point.
Well, to shift the question just a bit, how in the world do you get to be a manager? Because again, we have those people too who are working entry-level jobs, or they're artists who don't want to do it anymore and who maybe had it busted through and they're like, hey, I think I just want to manage. And people may come to you like, how do people become a manager?
Well, I think what makes you a good manager is experience.
In something?
Well, that's where I was going to go with it. I think in something. I mean, I think this is such a small town in some ways. And when I say it in town, I'm referring to Nashville mostly, is that it's just such a small community of people, and we all learn from each other. We all work really well together, and we all get along for the most part, I think. It's fair to say. You know, it's finding the avenue that, you know, where you're passionate about. In some cases, it's in the songwriting community and you're working in the publishing world and you decide you want to make a move into management. Then you find that artist that you really want to work with. Like you find, you know, and I encourage people, if they're in high school or college, you know, find that local talent and work with them and try to help them and learn as you go. It's experience for the most part that really gives you the credentials to become a manager. I'll tell you, for me, what I think makes me good at my job in management is that I have been in this industry a long time, and the gray hairs are showing it. But for me, I was in the marketing department at a record company, and that's where I learned about radio, and that's when I learned about sort of branding and working with artists and knowing the sort of the nuances of the artist. And I think for me, that's given me a broad scope of the industry as a whole that makes me, I think, a valuable part of the management team, is knowing already the nuances of the labels and the decisions that need to be made there. So I think it's really grinding it out in the industry for the most part. I do think there are a lot of people that wave their hands when they come out of college. They say, I want to be a manager, and they start working with artists, but they just don't know as I said, roadmap earlier. They don't know the roadmap, and so they're just figuring out as they go. And, you know, I was lucky enough going to Belmont. I went to Belmont University, and I majored in music business, and I did internships. I jumped into the intern world. I think Mike D, who's sitting at the table with us here, is a glowing example of it. You know, you just got to get involved, you know, and as soon as you can, if you want to be in management, it's getting an internship, you know, and working in the management community and learning and just growing. And then you become an assistant within the management community. Then you become a day-to-day manager, which means you're handling the calendar, and you're making sure that the days and the minutes are being taken care of, and that the artist is where they need to be. And then you kind of grow into a more strategic manager and become a manager and have a roster of your own. But it's time and experience. That's a long answer to your question, but I think sort of helps illustrate. It's time and experience mostly that makes you a good manager.
You're doing marketing at Universal. You leave to go to Red Light to be the marketing guy there as well. When did you go, hey, I think I actually want to, you know, get my hands dirty and actually work with an artist? And who was the first artist that you actually were in with, where you were making decisions for them specifically?
Well, when I came over to Red Light, I did not necessarily have designs to be a manager. I was looking for a new opportunity. I'd been in the record company business for going on 20 years at that point. I'd started at a small company in town called Rising Tide when I was finishing at Belmont, but I was working there basically full time and worked there for a couple of years. And then I went over to Mercury Records, and I'd seen the sort of the change of the industry. And at that point, Napster had hit this again dates me, but that's when Napster hit the scene. And I could see how that was changing the record industry, because Mercury Records, there were a lot of independent companies. There was Lyric Street Records, there was DreamWorks, there was Mercury, there was MCA, there was Arista, there was Giant Records, there was Curb. I mean, there was all these record companies around town. And I was working for Mercury. And at that time, had a really strong roster. Shania Twain was on the roster, and what was sort of the biggest artist that they had at that time. And it was coming off of the Come On Over record, which was selling Diamond, which was 10 million. And if you look at stats today in terms of what records are getting certified, it's almost unheard of today. When you put in streaming equivalents, you know, people are getting there. But that was huge. So it was Shania Twain, and it was Terry Clark and Sammy Kershaw and Jamie O'Neill. And then we had the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack that just sort of blew up. But what we were seeing was that we were seeing a huge decline in sales that were starting to happen. And with that, then all the mergers. So Mercury then became Mercury MCA. We merged with MCA, and I saw a staff decline. They had to let some people go. And then it was Mercury MCA DreamWorks when we merged with DreamWorks, and I saw staff and layoffs. And then we shut down that imprint, DreamWorks, altogether. And then we merged with EMI Capital. So then that became what is now known as Universal Music Nashville, which is Mercury MCA Capital and EMI. And then I saw the same thing. I saw layoffs. And so I was through this, I don't know, just kept seeing this changing environment and layoffs and consolidations, and what seemed to be do more with less people, less money was what seemed to be the strategy. And so at that point, then that's, you know, like I said, almost 20 years later of kind of going through that grind. And luckily, you know, I always had a home at a record company during all that. But I did start to think, man, there's got to be a different path for me. I keep seeing the decline within the record companies. And, you know, where is my skill set? And, you know, for me in marketing, the other places to work in the industry, and there are several, it's, you know, business management. I don't have an accounting background, so I can't just jump into business management. I hadn't been working in the touring environment, so I couldn't just jump into being a booking agent. And, you know, I wasn't an attorney, you know, and I hadn't worked in the merch business. So I was just thinking, what's my next path? And, you know, I think to be a good manager, you have to be a good marketer. I think everything is marketing, really. And so I just kept thinking that probably my next life in the industry is in the management world. And that's, the timing was right for me as I was starting to have this internal struggle about what's next for me and my path in the industry was right at that time when we had merged with EMI Capital. And I also had felt at the company, I felt like I saw my path earlier before we merged with EMI Capital. I'd sort of rose in the ranks and I was the VP of marketing at Mercury MCA. And then with the merger, there was a whole new group of folks came in, a new head of the company, the head of the company that had been there prior. Luke Lewis had always been, you know, sort of he was my mentor and boss at that time. And I felt like I always had home for him, and he left. And that's when Mike Dungan came in and ran the company. And I'd known Mike for a long time, and I've heard his name multiple times on this podcast because he's had such an influence, and he has on me. But still, he wasn't my guy necessarily. And so then I had to adapt into this new team. And I didn't feel like I necessarily had my long-term path at this new Universal Music Group company. And so I was keeping my eyes and ears open. And that's when I think seeing some of that change in the industry, Corin Capshaw, who was the head of Red Light, had heard my name. And actually with a colleague, a woman by the name of Mary Hilliard, had mentioned my name to Corin because he was looking to expand the Nashville office. And the reason he was looking to expand the Nashville office was kind of the same reason I was looking to leave the record company, because he had seen the trend of the record companies. And if you're having a management company, you put a lot of your hope and trust in the manpower that you expect to have succeed with an artist with the record company. You're hoping the record company has the resources to really support your artist and break your artist in the marketplace. And he was seeing that trend, managing artists. He was seeing that all these record companies that we were signing our artists to, a lot of these record companies were reducing their staff, reducing their budgets. And so he kept thinking, well, gosh, as a management company, I can't leave, you know, the future of artists in the hands of record companies solely if they're declining. So I need to start building out my staff. And so he knew that this change was happening over at Universal, and Mary Hilliard had said, hey, I know this guy, Tom, and recommended that Corin just meet me. And it's so funny. She reached out to me and said, hey, you want to meet this guy, Corin? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was just to meet him. I didn't necessarily know or think that it was a interview, but if you know Corin, and Bobby, I know you do, you know, he's right to business. You know, there's no, hey, let's talk about your life. I mean, it's like, tell me what you do. Tell me what you do for the record company. You know, do you ever work in international? Have you worked in, I mean, he was straight to business, and I left the lunch with him and I thought, well, that wasn't like a get to know. That was an interview. And we just kept conversation. And then he invited me to join Red Light. And I told him, I said, listen, I've never managed anybody. So I don't know that, I mean, I'm very interested, but I don't know that I would have to learn. And he said, well, I don't necessarily need you to manage anybody. I want you to come and help me with marketing and help. Let's make this company a bigger and better management company. And that's when I left the record company, which is a little bit of a leap of faith. I mean, my personality, I like some risk, but sometimes risk adverse. And I'd been at the record companies for, like I said, almost 20 years. And so I felt comfortable. I had my 401k, you know, and all those things. But I don't think I was feeling fulfilled. And, it was my wife who said, Tom, listen, I think you need to make a change, you know, for your own self personally, but also professionally. And, I love my former employees and colleagues over at Universal and all the record companies I worked with, but that was the best move I could make. I immediately felt more fulfillment and enjoyment out of management. And I just really got the bug and I started to really understand it more. So to answer your question, this is a long answer to your question, but you asked what made me decide from marketing to get into more specific artist management. And I think it was learning more about what that business is. And when I was sitting in the seat of the record company, I felt like we were the only ones doing the work. And you'd hear people at the record company complaining and saying, man, what's the manager doing? I feel like we're doing all the work. And then when I started working at the management company, I realized what goes into artist management. I mean, it is a sometimes thankless job, not with you, Bobby, but sometimes thankless job, but it's 24/7. It's all the time. And, you know, we're dealing with the record company, but we're also dealing with something in their personal life. We're also dealing with, you know, like I said, their touring and their merchandise and their PR issues or whatever it may be. And so it is a constant thing. But I found And it, I think this it is a part of my personality is I sort of thrive in that chaos. I really loved it. And so having been at Red Light for a while, and in my role of kind of overseeing marketing, there were a couple of artists that had started to join the Red Light team, but didn't necessarily have a specific manager that we're working with, or had been working with a manager, and that relationship, for whatever reason, just didn't work out. And there was a young kid, and this was sort of my first quote-unquote artist that I started working with, and it was a young kid by the name of Adam Sanders, and he had a hit with Cole Swindell. He wrote a hit for him and wrote a song for Dustin Lynch that was a number one single, Hell of a Night, and had a cut on Luke Bryan's record, and he was a young, talented artist, and at the time, I was helping him with his marketing and his manager, and he just split, and he said, listen, I'd like to stay at Red Light, and, you know, would you work with me? And that's when I started to really work with and focus on a single artist and kind of help them along. And, you know, I was careful not to jump too far and deep into the quote unquote management side, more specifically with an artist, because my role was also doing marketing. And, but I just love that ability to focus on a single artist. And I think that's the one thing in my role in marketing. It's hard for me to get really entrenched into the day to day with the artist because there's so much going on in an artist's career, and that's what the manager in the day-to-day is doing. And so I was sort of flying at 30,000 feet with a lot of these artists and joining in a marketing meeting with them and able to offer some suggestions or ideas. But, you know, I didn't feel like I was, you know, having that direct impact on their day-to-day. And I think that's what gave me a little bit more of the bug to say, man, I'd really like to do that with a few artists that I feel passionate about and or people that I feel passionate about. And that's where it's sort of led me to some of the artists that I'm working with now. You grow really personally attached to these artists, working with them, and you want to see them succeed. And that was my move. I think at that point, I still oversee the marketing team, but also have to balance that and focusing on some of these artists that I work with. But I love it on a day to day basis.
Sugarland is another artist when they're together that you manage. How in the world are folks making money when you can't tour?
Great question. They're making some, and to clarify that, I've worked with Sugarland from the day they signed a record deal at Mercury Records. I was sitting in the lobby of Mercury Records when this new trio at the time came into the lobby and was introduced to us as this band, Sugarland, and it was Kristen and Jennifer and Christian, the three that were the founding members of Sugarland. And so I had done the marketing for them when I was on the record company side. And when I left and came into management, Christian Bush at the time, this was when they took a little bit of a break and both pursued some other opportunities that they had, which I think was healthy for them. Christian was looking for some management support for him. And so he came over to Red Light and I started working with him. And it was just a natural fit because we had worked together before. And so when Sugarland came back together, I've worked with Christian, and then there's a woman, Gail Gelman, who works with Jennifer, and we make it work working together for them. And right now, it's a great question. They're victim to it, as all of these artists are. How are they making money today? There are a couple of ways that an artist can make money outside of touring, but I'll tell you, it is definitely the biggest part of their pie, and as with management, because managers, as you said, you know, the financial structure for manager is that we basically participate in 15% of an artist's income, and really income of all spheres, you know, so that's from their merchandise, it's from personal appearances or brand deals or whatnot. But a lot of that centers around touring, and touring is where the most money is made. And in fact, I know, you know, a segment that you had before, you were talking about sort of appearance fees for artists, and you were kind of going through how that works. And you know, I think when you look at it, even for an artist that, you know, when you look at the quote-unquote rate card that you had thrown out there on some of those artists is, you know, if an artist makes $40,000 for an appearance, that's not $40,000 that goes into their pocket. You know, it's they have expenses tied into it. It's the travel cost to get there. They have to pay their band and crew. They have to pay the commissions for the booking agent, their business manager, their manager. And, you know, at the end of it, that $40,000 probably turns into $10,000 or whatever it may be. And so it gets thinner. Now, the bigger you play, the bigger venues you play, the bigger your guarantees, you know, after expenses, you're bringing home more money. But at the end of the day, it is from the touring side where the majority of the money comes in. And right now, people are at first when COVID impacted the touring business, you know, there were a lot of people that I think, well, I think a lot of us, if not all of us, really hoped that this was just a few months and then we'll be back in business. I mean, that's what I was a big part of in the start of this was, okay, all of the tours that were going to start in April or May, let's move them to June and July. And then we're thinking, okay, maybe we'll just move some of these to August, September. And then it just kept moving and moving and moving. So when it first hit and impacted our business, I don't think we were as much concerned about the financial impact as we are today, because it's obviously having a bigger impact knowing the delay that it's put on touring, again, the biggest part of all of our business. So at first, I think people were just wanting to stay engaged, and they were doing the virtual shows, and they were Facebook Live all the time, and a lot of times those were just free, and it was just free entertainment for fans to stay engaged until we got back to business. And then I think you've seen from that somewhat fatigue from that, I think on the consumer side, but also on the artist side, but also artists saying, okay, now I have to monetize this. I got to figure out a way to monetize this, because if this is our quote unquote new normal for right now, you know, I can't afford to just do free shows all the time, because that's not feeding my crew. It's not feeding my family. And so a lot of artists have moved into more branded, sponsored virtual events. There's still a way to stay. I mean, listen, all of these artists in their own right are influencers, you know, and they have big followings, you know, and there are artists that, you know, have millions of people on Instagram and Facebook, any of the social platforms, and that it is of value to brands right now, some brands. Now, I think it's impacted brands as well. You know, I mean, I think everybody's suffering from it, but I think you're seeing that from sponsored content. I think you're seeing it from virtual shows. I think you're seeing it from flash sales and what people can do from merchandise. Those are where a lot of those artists are making money. Now, if you're an artist that is also a songwriter, that's different. You're able to have success if your songs are being played at radio. That business is still there in the streaming business. There's income to be made on the publishing and performance rights side. Sorry, I'm getting in the weeds on it. But, you know, I think the basic point is without touring, that's probably an impact of 80% of any given artist's, and I would say management company's, income right now.
Have you seen anything like Luke Combs in your time at in the label or working with management?
I'll tell you, I think the closest thing I can compare him to is what I felt like the impact of Garth Brooks was on the community. And I wasn't even really in the business at that time, but once I joined the industry, everybody referred to him and I was a fan, you know, as I know you are. But man, he hit the scene and hit it fast. You know, it's Much Too Young to Feel This Damn Old, which was great, but then it was Friends in Low Places and Unanswered Prayers and Thunder Rolls and all of the, I mean, it was just hit after hit after hit after hit, almost like the Midas touch. Everything he touched was gold, you know, and I can compare a similar impact the way Chris Stapleton impacted, but I can't even put those two together because Chris had been around this town for 15 years. He was in the Steel Drivers and the Johnson Brothers. I mean, he had already been in the industry for some time. Luke seemed to come out of nowhere and is categorized, and I think rightfully so, as a superstar. He is a superstar now. So to answer your question, not necessarily. I mean, I think you could Shania Twain, but she had a record before she really, like, really hit when she partnered with Mutt Lange, and then that's when the Woman in Me record came out and Whose Bed Had Your Boots Been Under, and then it was a rocket ship then, but it wasn't quite the same immediate impact that I think Luke is having.
What about Al Dean?
Al Dean, I think, I guess a little different because, well, now that you say it, he had immediate hit with his first single. Hicktown was his first single?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
The only person I've heard compared to Luke Combs in this generation, because Garth is the last, the one right before us,
yeah,
is Al Dean.
That's probably a good one. And I remember, because I was in the industry when that happened. And I think what surprised people most, too, was that it was an independent record company. This was a new record company. Benny Brown had started with Broken Bow Records, and here was this, you know, New Kid that hit. And you're right, it was hit after hit for him. I think Luke's trajectory, at least it seems perceptually for me right now, seems to even has sort of exceeded that. But I think that's a great example. Jason did have immediate impact, and then, you know, just years later is selling out, you know, Georgia Stadium and having, you know, the tremendous success. But that, but listen, you, any of the superstars that we have today, it didn't happen overnight. You know, Luke Bryan, a great example, who, as we mentioned earlier, you know, it was a couple records in when he really, really hit. Was it Tailgates and Tan Lines that was like, at that point, he had arrived. Eric Church wasn't immediate, you know, and that took a bit, and then superstar. Carrie Underwood, I think, had tremendous impact with her first single, but I think it was a little different. I think that was, I don't think it, it didn't feel, it, she came off of a, you know, American Idol too, and I don't know. I don't know that I could put it the same way. Miranda took a while before Kerosene and then really started to have hits, and it, it doesn't happen like it, you see it with Luke Combs, you know, and, you know, I give it to him. I, he's done no wrong so far, and, you know, good for him. I'd like to see that. You know, I want to see young, I want to see new superstars. I think we as a format have to have that. Not that we, not that you want to see people evolve out. And I think that's the beauty of country music, is that country artists can have those 20, 30 art, you know, year careers. And I think you've seen it with George Strait and the Alan Jacksons, Martina McBride, who's still having success. Maybe not the same relative success that you see if you're benchmarking it against radio, but she's still able to go out there and tour. And you look at all of these other artists, the Mark, you know, the Mark Chestnuts and Mark Wills, and, you know, and, you know, God rest his soul. But Joe Diffie was having a really strong career, you know, in resurgence. And so these artists are able to have really, really long careers. So, like I said, I don't want to see them evolve out, but I think it's important that we continue to elevate as an industry, elevate superstars, because that is only, that's only healthy for our, I think, our genre and our format, because it continues to bring new audience in. You don't want our audience to completely age out. You want the younger audience to have an artist that they can champion, the same way I think you and I, or me specifically, was championing, you know, Garth Brooks at the time, or Dwight Yoakam at the time when it hit for me. Like, these are, those are the artists that I felt like I owned a little bit, you know? And so, you know, to see these young superstars, and, you know, there are artists that are now headliner, you know, Dan and Shay, you know, that's not an overnight success. Superstars now, you know, and, you know, kudos to it. 'Cause it's not easy, you know, being in this industry, man, it is tough to get to that level. It's easy. It may be, well, it's not even easy, but you can have a hit, you know, you can have a hit, but to impact, I think that's something that is, that's a difference, you know, and that's what you've seen in impact from, you know, we said Gabby earlier, Gabby's having really strong impact right now with this one song. Now, our challenge, her challenge will be to back that up. But Chris Stapleton, impact, once he really kind of hit the scene. But again, that was a grind for him. You know, I was there at Universal when, you know, Chris sort of took his first step as a solo artist, if you will, in the kind of commercial country landscape, and put out some great music. There was a single called "What Are You Listening To" that it's still in a heavy rotation in the Lord household, which is my household. Just so you know, it's not heaven I'm referring to, people. It could be playing up there also, but you know, and to me, you had hoped and thought, and I think that's the thing with management that's a struggle, is that you know, you get attached to these artists, and you just you it seems so obvious to you their talent, and seems so obvious that they should succeed. And I think Chris Stapleton was one of those artists. When he first came through, it was like, well, this is a no-brainer. This guy's got it all, you know? And
I mean, this is about the time I met Chris, because I was having him on the show when the song came out.
Well, that, you know, yeah, that's right. You were in early, same thing. You saw that too, you know, early champion.
Loved
form.
Him. Was getting in trouble for putting him on the air because nobody had ever heard of him. Like executives in radio.
Yep.
Because I was being eyeballed hard every move. Because I was different at what I was doing. So, like, why are you doing this? And so we have a video of Chris, because he'd come in 4 or 5 times early. And the first time I ever called him, I called him, he was in the shower. He was like, hey, man, I'm in the shower. Can I call you right back? I was on the air. And I was like, yeah, man, we'll call you back in a minute. And so he came in and he did a bunch of his hits. Your Man, Josh Turner. He did, he came back later, did Drink a Beer from Lou that he wrote. But I was like, this guy is so pure, just as a as an artist. He's probably not the most perfect singer, but he's the best in my mind. Like, I was just moved by him. And when he finally hit, I was like, holy crap. And I, again, the Stapleton thing, I've never seen anything album related like I have with Stapleton's, with that album that had Tennessee Whiskey and...
Whiskey and You, and it said Fire Away, and you know, and that's that was The Traveler. I mean, it was
Parachute.
The Parachute was on that record,
I haven't, album-wise, I've seen nothing like that album since I've been in town, which is about 8 years now, because it just stayed at number one.
Yeah, it's still, I think, if you look on some of these streaming charts, it's still one of the top streamers, which is unbelievable. And I think the point I was making with him is that, you know, you see some of these artists that you think, you know, it seemed no brainer, and that they can have their shot, and that they're gonna, you know, they're gonna have immediate impact, and sometimes it doesn't, you know, and sometimes it doesn't work for whatever reason. And I think, you know, not everybody sees, and that's it's sort of the beauty and also sort of the frustrating thing about music. It really is so subjective in so many ways. I mean, there are songs that I hear on records that I go, oh my God, that's a hit, you know, and instead, you know, they release something else, and I'm like, oh, that's not gonna work, and then it becomes a multi-week number one. You know, it's, we all have our opinions there, and I think with Chris, I thought that was going to hit immediately, and I have to imagine, and he and I have not had a conversation about it, but I have to imagine that was really frustrating for him, you know, but he stuck with it, and then he made a record that, as you said, has really stood the test of time, and you know, that's what I get off on in this industry, is seeing those artists succeed that really, you know, that truly have that talent, and everybody has their own talent they bring to the table, but with him, it's been fun to see that kind of impact. And I think that's that when you ask about living the world of Luke Combs right now, and I don't work with Luke, but I've seen what he's doing, and that, you know, seeing what the impact that Chris had, I think it's important, like I said, for this format. We've got to continue to bring superstars to the stage.
I'll end with this, because your background is in music. You studied music at Belmont?
Music business, yeah.
Okay, so it's all been music. So what in the world would compel you to want to work with me? Because only one part of my business is music.
I told you I sort of thrive in the chaos. And I like the challenge of things. And I think for any manager, the worst thing that you can do is have a client that does not want it as much as you want it for them. And what I mean it is success. You know, there are a lot of artists that just sort of expect, or clients, or however you want to define them, that just expect success is going to happen, and they don't want to work for it necessarily, or work as hard as you need them to work. When we first worked together, or started working together, you know, I think you challenged all of us internally in sort of laying out what your goals were. And it wasn't just to be status quo, and it was to elevate, and it was to write a book, and it was to have a TV show, and it was, I mean, you've always aspired for more, and, you know, that's a big part of your personality, and that really that ignited me, I think, is where I was going with it. I think I was drawn to your desire to keep growing, and I like to think that we have a fit just personality wise. Like I just liked you. I liked you as a person and wanted to see you succeed. And I got it. Like I understood it. Like, and I don't know. That's what really compelled me to work with you, is seeing your drive and to see you want to succeed, and you're not satisfied with the status quo, and you want to try different things. And that just keeps me growing too. And I think that has for me been a personally rewarding and professionally rewarding.
Let me shout out Tom Becci in case he's listening, because you and Tom are both my direct guys. And so you come from a creative music background where he's a business guy.
Yeah.
And have you ever worked directly with Tom until me?
Yeah. In fact, so we were at Universal together. He came in, when we merged together, when I was at Mercury MCA, he was COO of EMI Capital. And we merged together. And so for a year, we worked together. But never directly. Like, he was sort of more on the business side. He was running the operations and doing the books and working on payroll and working on the artist agreements. And it was all more legally stuff. And I was more in this other sort of creative world where it's marketing and marketing campaigns and bigger strategy and content creation and et cetera, et cetera. And But we always had a mutual respect. And when he joined Red Light after me, I'd like to think he followed me there. When he joined, we both had a role at Red Light that was different than others. He was helping with more of the operational stuff, and I was helping more of the creative stuff. And so we just found ourselves working together. And I think that's what you want in a management team is are people in your team that complement each other. And, you know, you described it. He brings strengths to the table that I don't have.
Far more.
No, I wouldn't say far more.
Far more strengths. Far more.
I wouldn't. Well, I mean, I wouldn't put it that way. I think he has some, but and I have other strengths, and I think we work really well together in that way.
And I'll mention Morgan, too, who came from radio and is now the position you talked about. When someone gets into management, she is my day-to-day. You know, she's watching the calendar. She's, you know, really making sure daily what's happening with me and enforcing at times. And so, and I assume Morgan's been good. I mean, I see she's branching out a bit, too.
Yeah, Morgan's been great, and that was an interesting search for us because we were looking for somebody to be in that role, and we saw the relationship and the sort of the evolution of Morgan in that she worked with you from an assistant level and sort of graduated
intern assistant. Yeah, phone screener,
and she had sort of evolved with you and grown with you. That we were lucky that we could sort of put her into that role and that she was willing to come into that role. And she's been great. And, you know, she's learned the ropes quickly. And I think that was, you know, that was the one thing that you said, how does somebody get into management? It is a learnable task. I mean, there are skill sets that come into it that I think, you know, that you either have or you don't, just from a personality trait. But, you know, you can learn the business. You learn any business. You know, I do think that there's some talents that you may not be able to master. Songwriting's one. You can learn how to write a song. It doesn't make you great at it. I've tried before. Morgan's been a huge addition, I think, to this team. And we'd like to see her grow. And I think that just makes us a stronger management company. If we can enable these folks that work within our Red Light structure to work with other artists and to learn, that's going to make us a stronger management company across the board.
As we wrap it up, the last couple sprinkles, we'll add the cupcake here, that if you want me to ever hear a song, you have to get it to Tom, not to me.
Let's not encourage that.
His email is
iHeartRadio.
How many times a week does somebody at least reference you working with me for their benefit?
It's growing by the day. I've had a couple within the last 7 days that have been, hey, you work with Bobby, right? And I said, yeah. So can you get him this record? I think again, it's the relationship that a manager and client or artist have is a trust thing. Like our relationship is built in a different way. It's built on me working with you in your career. I'm not in the programming business with you. I'm not in the radio business with you, and I don't pretend to be. And I would never. And I think that's a part of what you have to balance as a manager is that you can't abuse that relationship. If it's not right, it's not right for me or for people to sort of assume that I can influence you.
Well, you can, and you do.
Well, we have conversations about artists, sure. But you know, the way we do, you know, there's some artists that I've championed and you've said, man, I'd really like that artist the same way you do for me. You come to me and say, hey man, what do you think of this artist? And I discover artists that way too. But yeah, I try to respect that with you. It's like, I can't be, I'm not a radio rep and trying to get, you know, everybody's singles played on the radio and influence you. And I try to, you know, respect that with you.
Mike, anything you'd like to ask Tom before we wrap it up?
I feel enlightened here.
I'm sure you do. Again, this is going to be the most consumed podcast. Yeah. I don't know what the records are.
Well, the over-under for this is 7 streams.
Yes, yeah,
literally 7.
Okay, that's mom, dad. It's me listening back 3 times. It's Stephanie, my wife.
The big takeaway here is, much like everything else in the music industry, there isn't an exact key that goes into the exact hole. You kind of got to figure it out by Jimmy in the lock sometimes.
You do, and follow up. I mean, whether it's the music industry or anything else, it's just following your passion. Listen, that's the reason I'm in it. It's not because I just was looking for a gig. You know, for me, coming out of high school, I'm glad we can extend the time here. Sorry, guys, I'm going to take another hour here. But you know, at 18 years old, you're sort of faced with in life to decide, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? What do you want to major in? What do you want to become? And for me, it was, I was playing baseball and I knew my skill set was not enough to take me to the major leagues. And I was playing in bands. I was playing music. I just loved it. But I knew, again, that I didn't necessarily have the skill to be a full-time musician. And that's when I learned about, you know, music business. And I went to Belmont University. I walked on for the baseball team, made the team for a couple of months, for a semester. I'll give myself a little more credit as a walk-on. And then started majoring in music business. And I just was enamored with it. And I just love it. And I still do today. Like, I still get fired up about music. I still love songs. I get so much enjoyment out of seeing artists succeed. So I guess that my point in all of that is, you know, if music's your passion, man, follow it, you know, or whatever it is. And there are so many opportunities in life that I don't know that I really ever knew of, you know, interior design or, you know, whatever it may be. You know, for me, it was like, you can be a doctor, a business salesman, an attorney, or a teacher. You know, it's like, I don't know, like, that's all I really knew of. And man, there's so many opportunities out there. But it starts with finding your passion. And I feel so lucky and blessed to be doing what I'm doing, because I just don't know what else I do, you know, that fulfills me.
Who wins Entertainer of the Year this year? This is it. Last question. Who wins Entertainer of the Year at the CMAs? If I'm going from memory here, it's Eric Church, Carrie Underwood, Luke Combs, Keith Urban, Miranda Lambert. I believe from memory that's the five.
That's pretty good. I think you may be right.
I just voted.
You did? Okay. I just voted.
Who wins? It's a tough one.
It's a tough one.
Because, you don't agree. You'd have to agree with what I'm saying. I think Luke Combs probably should win.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this community sometimes penalizes people for being too big too fast. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, wait your turn.
I agree.
You saw that with Dan and Shay.
I agree.
Did you say Miranda Lambert?
I did.
Yeah.
I think Luke Combs should win. I tell you, I voted for Carrie because I feel like just she deserves it. And for me, there's no identifier what Entertainer of the Year means other than entertain me. So TV,
yeah.
Sketch comedy, Instagram, your radio hits, your tour, that full encompassing entertainment is what that is to me. And that is why I voted for Carrie, because to me, she's the most that.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have the radio success Luke Combs does, at least not last year or the last 2 years. But there's no wrong answer, because if Eric Church wins, you go, I get it.
That's where I was going to go with it, is like, man, I don't think there's a wrong vote there. And I know this is such a political answer, but I sort of live in a political world in my business. But there's no wrong answer to that vote. And the reason, because I think they all deserve it for different reasons. Luke Combs, I don't disagree. Probably on paper right now.
If it was stat-based, Luke Combs would run away with it.
Deserves it. And I don't think anybody would go, But I do think you're right. People reward people, or the voters reward artists that have also put in more time. And I have to say, what Eric Church has done over the last couple of years blows my mind. You know, that he plays a 3.5-4-hour set by himself. You know, it has three different, like, he plays a full band show, then breaks it down and does an acoustic set, and then comes back out. I mean, you want to talk about Entertainer of the Year, if it's based on that, that's a lot of work.
And some people do, based on touring and how entertaining you are live.
That is correct. Carrie Underwood, who has been hit after hit after hit, consistent, and when you talk about entertainment, I mean, her styling and her graphics, I mean, all of that, I think, again, deserves it. Miranda Lambert, I don't count her out, because that's another one who has consistently been a stalwart in this industry and continue to have success. But also what I've seen with her is sort of lift up other artists. And I think that is recognized by the industry. We could have a whole nother conversation about voting and who to vote for and why to vote for them, because I think that's what I've sort of argued. And this is a little bit in our backyard, red light that is, but like with Luke Bryan, and I referenced him again earlier, where I think Luke Bryan has been that artist, you know, and everybody said, well, you got to vote for Garth Brooks. He sells more tickets. I get it. Garth, who nobody can deny Garth's, you know, reason for winning Entertainer of the Year. And I think well-deserved. But from Luke, who entertains people with consistent singles at radio. I mean, consistent number one singles at radio. Amazing, just entertainer and personality.
Idol.
America. That's where I was going to go with it. You want to talk about entertainer?
That's why Carrie has my vote.
Yeah.
But again, there isn't a specific rule that dives into why you should vote for a single person.
That is correct.
It's almost like obscenity by the FCC. There is no rule on what's obscene.
Right.
It's just whatever your community feels is what it is. And if they get irritated and they complain, then we may fine you.
Yep.
You're just like, give us a rule here.
Totally right. There's no, there. That's, you wish that there was a more specific benchmark to it. I mean, it's overall entertainment. What is that? How do you define that? And that's why, for me, I've sort of been standing on the box for, you know, Luke Bryan for...
I agree, he got screwed over.
Yeah, and the last couple of years, he continued to
He just
to
won
deliver.
Too much. I'm telling you, he won too many things. He got Angelina Jolie. They started taking her off in front of magazines because she was winning every hot award.
Right.
And then nobody wanted anything to do with her because she was plastered all over everything else.
Yeah.
And I think Luke had to suffer his success.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And, you know, at the same time, I like to see new names in the category. So Luke Combs, let's say Luke, the other Luke, took Luke's spot, let's say. You know, you can't take that away from him. He deserves it too.
Absolutely. I think Dan and Shay could have been put up there.
I think Dan and Shay could
You're
have.
You're talking about people that are getting screwed over a little bit in awards? Because awards are very political. I think Florida Georgia Line gets dicked over a little bit.
I was about to go there. Mm-hmm. Like,
because they're massive. They put out such quality as far as generally people love it.
Correct.
And they're not recognized by the community of voters as much as they should be.
That was the example that was in my head too. And I have championed them for a bit too, because there's some great duos. I think Brothers Osborne, who's amazing. And, you know, the industry really loves and has championed them. Dan and Shay, hard to argue that they shouldn't win now too, because of the success that they've had. But prior to them, and even sort of compared to Brothers Osborne, Florida Georgia Line was putting up the numbers. They were putting up the numbers, whether it's touring, whether it's the radio hits, the consumption numbers. You know, Meant to Be was one of the most consumed songs. A Cruise, for God's sakes, it was one of the most consumed songs in the history of country music. But for whatever reason, wasn't getting the vote. And so you're right. It's not always who deserves to win. But again, that's a little subjective too, as we just said.
It's all subjective. If it wasn't subjective, I'd be hosting the CMAs, but it's all subjective.
Robert?
Yeah, Robert. All right.
Sarah?
Tom Lord, thank you very much. We've been here for 7 hours. Wow, who knew? I've asked only two questions.
It felt every bit of it. Yeah. Yeah, it felt every bit of it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Jamie Lynn.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I was watching some of your Instagram story today, and I was flipping through Instagram in general. You are everywhere today. You were on Ryan's show, Seacrest. I saw you on like three different news shows. Is today or yesterday and today big press days for Zoe 101?
I honestly, I'm so lost in it. I know the video releases today. So
yeah.
Like the official video comes out for everyone today on my YouTube. So I think today is the big push.
Right, you're everywhere. You're everywhere I look right now. That's pretty cool. So congratulations.
Thank you. Well, congratulations to you too. I'm so happy for you. When I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, he did it.
Jamie Lynn told me, Mike, that she had a dream. I was having babies already.
But this was like, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. I can't remember. And it was just you had a baby and you were like, you were happy. Like dreams, you kind of remember bits and pieces, but the overall feeling was happy. It was not like a bad thing. It was like a good thing. And I was just like, that's so strange. Maybe it's I was listening on the radio and my kids screaming. I don't know. Maybe that's what I dreamed about it.
Well, I appreciate that. Anytime anybody says or thinks anything good about me, I appreciate. So before we get into the Zoe 101 stuff, I just want to reset my audience for a second. Because I think you are such a talented songwriter and such a talented performer, aside from Zoe 101, because maybe some folks, they're on the young side of it or on the older side of it, didn't catch it. So what I want to do is brag on you for 1 second before we talk about that. And the song that Jamie Lynn came into my studio to play, the first time I'd met her, was this one here called How Could I Want More? And then she also wrote for Jana Kramer, I Got the Boy. Here's a clip of that. I got the first kiss.
she'll get the last.
And so I say all of that to set you up, because now we just believe you're good. So tell me about this, the new song from Zoe 101.
Well, as you know, obviously, writing music, creating music is like everything to me. But I am a creator, and also I do have, you know, family I have to provide for. So I was able to find another way to have a creative outlet, and being able to go back into the Zoe era, but not only with the show, but the music as well, because the theme song was like one of the cast members. People loved it just as much as they loved us. So we never fully released it. I figured during this time where everybody's on lockdown, why don't we throw together some Zoom co-writes and let's rework it a little bit and let's give them the theme song and give the fans what they want. So that's what we did. We just kind of reworked it. I went to a studio during COVID, like, and this is like in the heart of COVID. I was by myself with a mask on, with the, you know, the engineer, with the producers on Zoom singing. They couldn't even hear really what it sounded like back. And that is how we recorded the song and got crazy.
Well, and so, you know, I'm seeing some of the new Zoe 101, you guys all together, the cast. What is it like to reunite with all of them?
It was great. Some of them couldn't be there. They were actually out of the country. Two of them were. But it was weird because my daughter was there, and she, my oldest daughter, was the same age as when I knew all these kids and was seeing them, like, consistently. So it was really weird seeing that, like, side by side, like, living in two times at once. And they were all great, and hopefully, you know, hopefully we can get everybody together for the reboot. But it was nice to be able to have the people that we did and just kind of catch up and relive, you know, relive our glory days.
When you say you're hoping you can get everybody together for the reboot, like, you're doing the reboot, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I've been involved with the creative, all of that. It's all happening. It's just, you know how it's really hard to get things in production right now. But, that it's all happening, yes.
Here's a question for you. What's it like to hang out with famous TikTokers in real life? Because are they always trying to film and TikTok something?
I did not see one of them with their phones in their hand, honestly. They were there. They were so professional. They were so kind. They were so, like, engaging with my daughters and my family. I was blown away by how these kids are so young but so professional. I think that it's just the way our world is now. And that's why I thought it was a good direction to go with, because, you know, whenever I was 12 and 13, all the 12 and 13-year-olds liked me, and now all the 12 and 13-year-olds love them. So bringing the two generations together and kind of having them side by side was a really neat, you know, neat idea for the whole, you know, the whole Zoe generation and the new Zoe thing. But they were so kind, and they were so professional and just nice, good kids, honestly.
Was there ever a rivalry between Nickelodeon and Disney kids?
You know, I never really felt like it was, because, like, Miley was always so kind to me. Me and her got along really well, and we saw each other at a lot of events, and we were friends afterwards. And I would assume that, you know, Zoe and Hannah Montana would have been the biggest competition. But for me, I was like, Hannah Montana's got this. I mean, she's huge. There's no competing with that, you know. So for me, I was just like, I'm lucky I get to do something I love to do. And it's really neat to meet other kids who do it. So I never felt that, but I definitely know that, like, there was that with some other kids that were in, like, our young Hollywood group.
With your oldest daughter, does she think you're cool yet outside of being her mom because of what of Zoe? Or are you cooler now because you get to introduce her to other people that she really thinks cool?
She does not think I'm cool. She finds me embarrassing, very high. But for the first time, when I told her that, you know, Dixie D'Amelio and Noah Beck, she doesn't even have a TikTok account, but just her friends, they all have them and stuff. So she just knows who these people are. It's just her generation. She told me she was proud of me.
Wow.
The other day. Yeah, I was like, well, I have made it. I tell you, she was proud of me because she said, you know, I see you everywhere. My friends are talking about you, and I got to meet these people, and thank you, Mama. I'm just so proud of you. And it just made me so happy.
The TikTok you did with your daughters where you were walking in front of them and they weren't looking up at you at all, quite funny.
Okay, well, that video caused, like, a big disruption in my house. I had to FaceTime my manager with my daughter with me, and I was like, Maddie's telling me I cannot post this. That is so embarrassing that I would shake my butt in front of the camera like that. Everybody's going to be talking to her at school about how I shook my butt in front of camera. And my manager's just, like, laughing. She's like, Maddie. And so, like, I showed a few people being like, is this that bad? And because she knew that, like, I said, y'all just sit here and don't pay attention. And then when I did that, she was very angry with me. So I ended up posting it anyways. You know, you got to do what you got to do for those likes, right?
you're preaching to the choir. Absolutely. Okay, listen, everybody out there listening to me right now, the official music video for Follow Me, Zoe 101, has already premiered by the time you hear this. The Zoe 101 revival will be a half reunion, half complete reboot. That's right. Right, Jamie Lynn?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'm in. I'm such a big fan of you and your music career, your being a mom traveling around with your daughter's softball team. It was like you were the coach. You're everywhere they were, you were. Just you as a person, I'm just such a big fan. So anytime you need anything, you can always reach out to me.
Thank you so much, Bobby. You are the best. And yes, I am the softball team mom. Have you know that? my proudest title. So thank you. You are the best. I'm so happy for you. I wish you all of the best things in the whole entire world as this new phase starts for you.
Thank you, Jamie. I'll talk to you soon, hopefully.
Thank y'all.
All right, bye-bye.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on StraightTalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.